Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week we are taking a moment to remember our fallen celebrities of 2020. I'm looking for the best memoir. Are we calling it a memoir?
Yeah, we can.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
Good enough.
Sure. The best memoir, the best book, the best biography from one of our fallen celebrities. For brevity, we'll just call them dead celebrities or celebrideds. What is that good with you guys?
Yeah, celebrideds. Sure. You may. It's a little clunky.
It's a little clunky. We'll workshop it throughout the episode. Okay. To help me pinpoint
little musical interludes.
Yeah, we'll put some music to this. To help me are two high school English teachers. Ian and Joe.
Nick, hello. My name's Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a dead celebrity who has written a book, it's such a strange
this
thing.
This seems
to
insult
say.
Incredibly crass.
Are you looking for the celebrity himself or are you looking for the book? I'm confused.
Yeah. Let me
listen.
Yeah.
Folks, every year at the pinnacle of American and indeed global culture, I'm speaking, of course, of the Oscars TM. Yeah. They have that thing where the music plays and then it says in memoriam and it's all right. The people that we lost. Well, this is our in memoriam. We have chosen the only two people who have died this year who we think matter, right? That's what we said.
That's what we're getting at. That's what we're getting at.
We looked through the vast ranks and we said, we care about these two people and that's it.
Look, we've had a lot of loss this year. Mm. But we've seemed to found the two people that are just a little bit more important than all the other loss.
Right. Right.
Is that how maybe we could word it like that?
Yeah. I liked in memoriam. In memoriam sounds a lot more respectful than celebrideds.
All right. Well, let's move on.
Well, Nick, my celebrated that I'm talking about this week is Alex Trebek, who isn't so much of a dead celebrity as he is like a dead uncle that came to my house every day at 3:30. I am talking about his course. I'm talking about, of course, his I think this has to be the most recent book we've ever read on this show. It was published in July of 2020. A book called The Answer Is Reflections on My Life by Alex Trebek.
I'm sorry. I'll introduce myself in a moment, but I'm just really concerned that a dead guy came to your house every day at 3
every
o'clock.
Every day at 3 o'clock. I couldn't get out of my head.
Yep. 3:30.
He wasn't dead at the time, guys.
Hello. My name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. My name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. They call me the king of segues, but I'm a high school English teacher by avocation. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a book by a celebrity,
I am, you
should read Being a Scot by Sir Sean Connery and Murray Grigger, who is his friend and ghostwriter.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Wow, this episode is just ripe for very relevant SNL references.
Yes.
Let's see, a fun Scott accent we could do. We could also, we're probably going to hear a lot of questions, like jokes in the form of questions, like what year was it written?
Could the interlude music be a snippet of the Jeopardy theme song? And now I do think, before we say yes, I do think that if you play over a certain amount, we are going to have to pay Merv Griffith a royalty.
More than 2 seconds. So, ooh, Nick, right, as our fearless, dauntless producer,
we can get the first two notes.
Wait, no, it's fine. It's fine. All we have to do is sing it ourselves. Then it becomes a parody and it's fair use.
We're building on the culture, of course. Okay, so Nick, whenever you are ready for us to do the interludes, just let us know and Ian and I will sing the Jeopardy think music.
No, I'm not going to do that. So I just want to take this opportunity to plug our clip show coming up, our end of the year recap episode where, maybe it's Nick's turn to give back a little something. And so I've been reading some of your recommendations, and I'll tell you, it's not that hard. I don't think reading this much is that hard. It's like you can get through a book. Some of these books, these are like a couple hours on audiobook. Yep. This is not that hard, people. Maybe just read a little bit more. It's not that bad.
You know, I think it's one of the problems with the way that we teach books in schools is, you know, when you teach a book in school, sometimes you'll plan it over the course of a quarter or something. So you think like over these 9 weeks, we're going to read Huck Finn. The problem with that is we're sending a message to students everywhere that it takes 9 weeks to read a book, which of course it doesn't. It takes hours to read a book, not weeks.
Yeah. Well, if you want to read it, it takes hours. If you don't, it could take years.
I was cruising. This whole conversation puts me in mind of just a shocking feat I discovered recently, and I want to share it with you. I was cruising the books subreddit, which is a great subreddit full of people talking about books. And there was somebody linked an article about an opinion piece by a judge for a very prestigious literary prize. The literary prize is called the Booker Prize. It used to be called the Man Booker Prize. And then the company that sponsored it dropped out. So now it's just called the Booker Prize. Anyhow, to be a judge for this, you have to choose the best book every year. To be a judge for this, they had 100. This person in the four other judges had 162 days and 162 novels to get through.
Wow!
By that date, and so they said that the kind of central conceit of this article was, I read a novel every day for 162 days in a row.
Why is this the premise?
Just like I'm blown away by that. And I wonder, could you guys do that? How much would it cost? How much would you have to be paid to do that?
162 novels in 162 days. I mean, it had to be a full-time job at that point.
No, this is the thing. This person has a full-time job.
Wow. Separate. Not one that they do a very good job.
This must have been real shit at that other job.
I don't know.
So one person reads 162 books and then... No. He tells everybody which the best one was?
No.
And then you win the Booker Prize.
Every year, five separate judges are chosen to adjudicate the best novel published this year. Okay. And so the long list drops sometime in July, and the short list drops later than that. It drops in September, I guess. And then fairly recently, it was awarded on the 19th of November. So
who won?
Actually, strangely enough, a Scottish novel, a guy named Douglas Stewart won, his debut.
Is this a long-winded way to bring up your book?
This sounds like Ian is strong arming. It sounds like a long
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
You're getting really complex, Joe.
check out the name of his book though. Shuggy Bane.
Fun to say.
It's one of these stories about like, wow, life sure is hard in Ireland, Scotland. Life is hard in Scotland, and there's crime, and there's sadness, and there's poverty, and people have alcoholism and stuff. It's really, really, it sounds like a real downer, but apparently award-winning.
Most good books are downers. We've established that. So
that has been a recurring theme.
So welcome everybody to You Don't Know Lit. Every week we pick a theme that's meaningless and we make two books. We fit them into that theme.
Forcibly.
It's a bit of a square peg round hole situation. And we just make it work. And then we pick a winner based on absolutely nothing. And so we do have a couple rules, which are also very important.
The rules for winning are very well
documented. Rule, of course, is...
what is it, Nick?
Only unavoidable spoilers.
There you go.
Only unavoidable spoilers. That's the first rule in which I am going to try to start enforcing. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And of course, rule number three, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. We do have a fourth meal rule, which we do like to dabble in, which is please include the page count and the year it was written, guys. That would be great. It's not really a rule. It's kind of like the fourth meal. It's not really a meal.
It's like etiquette. It's like a agreed upon, maybe like decorum.
So with that, let's move right along to our 30-second plot points. Joe, why don't you kick us off?
All right. Alex Trebek is iconic. He has been the host of Jeopardy for 36 years. That's my entire lifetime and then some. He's been a constant and familiar presence in our homes. Jeopardy surpasses pop culture and has transcended into an institution from the Jeopardy.
I think you need to explain Jeopardy. Oh, that's going to be time.
What is Jeopardy?
What stuff about his mustache and like the answer is, it's fine.
Is he the same as,
get it? Think of it.
He doesn't have anything right now.
Pat Sajak?
No.
Ian?
Yep.
Tell me about the Scott.
There it is. Okay, legendary Scottish actor Sir Sean Connery has a fascinating life story, rags to riches. From minor parts in stage productions to playing the definitive James Bond, from the alleys of Edinburgh to being voted the greatest living Scot, my book this week doesn't focus on any of that. Instead, it makes a thorough argument for Scotland being the best country ever. Being a Scot, Sean Connery's 394-page 2008 memoir is as unexpected, complex, and infuriating as the man himself.
How many pages?
394.
Oh, that's a lot of pictures.
Like a lot of pictures.
Joe definitely broke rule number four.
You really? Well, you didn't let me finish, Nick. yeah, I feel like you were really talking this up as like I thought you were reading like a 900-page book this week. You talked this thing up as a tome.
Yeah, I thought it was, but I got
the abridged version.
No, it's just a larger version with bigger pages. I think.
Did you get the large print edition?
The first, well, like a smaller print. The first edition, I think, was like 450 pages, but this is a full 50 pages shorter.
So here's the thing. I'd like to start with Jeopardy. The anticipation for the Sean Connery book is quite great. Just the brief backstory. Well, I'm sure we'll get into this, but this book is impossible to find. Is that briefly
it
accurate,
is.
Ian?
Is.
Okay. Impossible to find. Impossible to Google and learn anything about. So, but is highly reviewed and rated. So let's save that for the end. So Joe.
Yeah.
Joseph.
I'm ready.
Joseph Holshoe.
Thank you.
Joel,
yes.
As who should say Joel.
Joel Shoe. Please.
Right. Didn't you think of that before?
I really don't like that.
I don't like it.
Oh, you're just afraid your kids are going to start saying it.
My kids do not listen to this.
Joe.
Yes.
Tell us about wonderful, wonderful Mr. Alex Trebek's recent book.
Okay. So I would actually like to start with a game.
Yes.
Of course. Classic.
That game is called Jeopardy. Guys,
this is secretly we're gonna full on play Joe's Jeopardy audition for to be the new Alex Trebek.
Ken Jennings, here I come. All right,
coming for
so
you, Ken.
I have exactly one Jeopardy category, guys. Right, it is called Potpourri, and it is all facts. Facts from Alex Trebek's life. We are going to play it as a round of double Jeopardy, but I do have answers. I do have questions, and I am going to be keeping score. The clues range from $400 to $2,000, and there are exactly 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them. So you would start this game by saying, for example, Joe, I would like potpourri for $400. I will read you the clue, and you each have the chance to buzz in at that point. And as, of course, you know, the buzzer on Jeopardy goes, doo-doo-doo-doo.
Okay. I love it.
Can I do a practice one, please?
Yes, of course.
Practice one? Oh, a practice
noise.
I've never
done it with my mouth.
A practice noise or a practice question?
A practice noise.
Oh, okay.
I want to make sure it's recognizable. Joe,
No, that try it again.
Perfect.
Good thing you practiced. You'll get it.
I'm laughing.
You'll get it.
I can't.
No, you got it. You got it for sure. Just take another round.
Yeah.
Take as many as you need.
If you wanted to like do this into the microphone, like Like you could like flick your lips with your finger if you want.
All right, let's do this.
So yeah, Ian, as returning champion, you can pick the first clue.
Take that, Nick.
Oh man.
Alex, I'd like potpourri for, I don't know, 2000.
Oh wow! This is a strategy in Jeopardy called the bounce. Ian is going for the high clues first. He'll be skipping categories. Yes. All right. $2,000. These are the two. Yes. Yeah, Nick.
What is Alex Trebek?
Ooh, no. I'm sorry. Fuck. Ian, would you like to guess?
Can I hear the whole clue?
Of course. These are the two sitting presidents who have appeared not as contestants, but as clue presenters on Jeopardy.
This one's all you, Ian. We are going to need an answer, though.
Who are Bill Clinton and Barack Obama?
Ooh.
That's good guesses.
No. You did get Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is one of them. Jimmy Carter is the other.
Jimmy freaking Carter? Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Jeopardy's been around for a while. A couple fun facts with that. Barack Obama did have a video intro to a teacher's tournament and not a sitting president, but John McCain was a contestant on the show in 1965, and he was a two-day contestant. He won his first, and the only reason he missed his second is because he missed Final Jeopardy, which was a literature clue.
Wait, was that 1965 before he went to Vietnam?
Yeah, 2 years before he was deployed to Vietnam.
That's insane.
It's pretty good.
That made my day. I don't know the rules. Am I $2,000 in the hole right now?
No. Yeah. I think you both
are. We both are. Yeah. It's tied. I'll be honest, guys. I thought every answer was going to be Alex Trebek. I went big, but you know, they don't all pay off. So let's move on, Joe.
All right. Yeah. So Ian, you still have control of the board.
I'll take, potpourri for 400.
For 400. This leader of the pack is one of the few Celebrity Jeopardy contestants who Alex Trebek says is good enough to play real Jeopardy. Ooh, that sounds like, I don't actually know who's ringing.
It's me.
All right, Ian.
Who is Aaron Rodgers?
Who is Aaron Rodgers? Ian, you are negative 1600. Good job.
Yes.
You have control of the board.
I'm not sure what the increments are, so I'll take the next highest.
Yes,
one.
The next is 800. Mm. This 800. Disease, which eventually killed Trebek, also killed Jeopardy's first host, Art Fleming. Yep.
Cancer?
Can we be more specific, please?
Pancreatic cancer?
Pancreatic cancer. Thank you, Nick. Right. Nick, congratulations.
Going dark with that 800.
All right. Nick, there's two clues remaining on the board, the $1,200 clue and the $1,600 clue.
1,600, please. Potpourri for 1,600.
This northern bovine, Alex Trebek's favorite animal, and the one of the primary targets of his charitable donations, circles the wagons with males pointing their horns outward, cows and calves shelter in the middle, to fend off wolves in the Arctic.
Damn it.
Yes,
that's
Ian.
Me.
It's me.
What is a moose?
Oh, I'm sorry. Nick, would you like to guess?
I didn't say what is an ox.
Ooh, Nick, I will accept that. It is what is a musk ox, Alex Trebek's favorite animal.
Hey, wait, hey, Joe. Hey, Joe.
Hey, yeah.
Shuck it, Ian. All right, sorry. Oh, no more of those. It's terrible. What is my score now?
You,
I know you guys aren't math teachers, but
you are 400 plus right now. Congratulations.
Yeah, I think win this.
No, you can break even at best. you can end up with $0 at best. All right. Final clue.
Last clue, please.
This man makes $3 million a year in royalties from the Jeopardy theme song.
Shit. How is that not the hardest one?
It's a really good.
What's our timer here? Because I'm not checking it up.
Yeah. Oh, Ian, you got in right under the timer.
Marvin Gaye.
I'm sorry. The correct answer is Merv Griffin. And
really?
Yes. And we do have Did you guys know the Jeopardy theme song? And that, by the way, brings us to the end of Jeopardy. The final standing is Nick wins with $400. And Ian will not be playing Final Jeopardy with us because he is negative $2,800.
I'm so sorry, Ian. Is this how good it feels to win when you guys win?
It's probably exactly what it feels like.
Is this what it feels like? It's nice.
So the Jeopardy theme song has lyrics. Did you guys know this?
Absolutely not.
So
please,
you could,
Joe, sing us the lyrics.
Well, I'll rhyme them for you. It goes as you know, the Jeopardy the think song goes do 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 do. Okay, so have lit heads have that tune in your head. The lyrics to that song are: we're in trouble, trouble deep. We're imperiled and endangered. I don't know how the endangered fits the cadence.
Who wrote the lyrics to this? Did Alex Trebek write them? Does he just sing it to himself in his head?
Merv and Alex were kind of jamming one day.
Before they
Merv wrote
this
the song,
book.
Alex wrote the words, and Alex was like, I'm terrible at this. Let me do a game show based on your theme. And that's where it started.
That's Ian. You basically summed up the entire book that I read this week. There it is. Yeah, and they do finish. We're in trouble. Yes, indeed. We are all in Jeopardy.
Oh, it wow. It has the name of the show.
The name of the show. It even
this
ends
is
with
blowing
an
my mind right
point.
Now, Joe. This is high quality literary content.
I'm guessing. So Merv Griffin does make $3 million a year from this song, total $80 million cumulative in his lifetime from the Jeopardy theme song.
I'm sorry to say that he is also a dead celebrity, a celebrity that he died back in 2007. So.
Okay, I should probably talk about the book. This book was a really weird book to read. And it was a weird book to read for a few reasons.
Because he's dead?
Well, not only was he dead, but Ian, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that when Sean Connery wrote Being a Scot, he didn't know that he was dying very soon.
Right. It was 12 years before he died. So yes.
Yeah. So okay. Alex Trebek wrote this well after his pancreatic cancer diagnosis. And not only that, but like he pretty much knew he was going to be stopping treatment at pancreatic cancer at the time that he wrote this book. So this book's kind of weird to read because like it is very much a goodbye letter to Jeopardy fans, to his family, to all these people that have grown to love Alex Trebek. How familiar are you two with the show? I assume you've seen it. Are you fans? Do you know a lot about it? Are you devout?
I mean, I'm a reigning champion, but
it is itself malignant in American culture.
Oh my god!
Oh wait, are we talking about Wheel of Fortune or Jeopardy?
I
feel that way about Wheel of Fortune. Jeopardy's fine. I don't know much about it, but I know it's fine. Mm.
Wheel of Fortune, also created by Merv Griffin, and was Merv Griffin's actually his favorite show, and he prided himself on writing many of the puzzles for Wheel of Fortune. But this isn't about Merv
Griffin.
Joe,
sing us the Wheel of Fortune song.
Wheel of Fortune. Wheel of Fortune.
Spin the wheel.
We know as much about Jeopardy as pretty much everybody, which is not much. It's a game show. With a beloved host and Ken Jennings.
Yeah, Ken Jennings is big. Also, there was a computer machine that had a victory
robot.
Or perhaps a defeat.
Yes, Watson.
A robot was involved.
Watson.
Wilson, yeah.
There's a section in every episode of Jeopardy. It is the worst section of every episode of Jeopardy, where after the first commercial break, they get to know the contestants. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, yes. Yep.
Alex Trebek starts at the end of the line. He goes through. He asks people to tell like some revealing anecdote about their life. And I think each contestant gets about 30 seconds for the banter with Alex Trebek.
Like, how did you lose all your teeth? Or
yep, that's
why
exactly
is there a tiger?
Why do you have a gun? Things like that.
Perfect. You guys, you get the flavor of it immediately.
Yeah.
This book is disjointed. And what it feels like is Alex Trebek giving his like just 30-second summary of his life after 30-second anecdote after 30-second anecdote.
Interesting.
It's very strange. It's split into something like 80 chapters, and the 80 chapters range from a paragraph long to, I would say on the high end, 5 to 6 pages long. Like, there's nothing long in this entire book, but they're all tiny, and some of them are teeny tiny.
Almost like little bits of trivia.
They feel Ooh. Like little bits of trivia. They even end with a lot of, very often they end with like a little joke, and you can almost hear Alex Trebek like breaking off the banter and going into the show when he tells this little joke. So just a very quick illustrative example.
Yeah.
He tells a story of he's staying at a ski chalet because of course he is. He's staying at a ski chalet and this woman comes up to him. This woman comes up to him and says, "You have to help me. My boyfriend's on drugs. And like, he's going to kill me." And the boyfriend comes into Alex Trebek's ski chalet with a gun, and Alex Trebek talks him down, but he puts his hands in his pocket while he's doing it. Right. It's this very brief chapter on bravery. So he talks down this boy, the entire time with his hands in his pocket. And by the time the guy puts the gun down, like, Alex is very proud of himself. And he comments that the only reason he put his hands in his pocket is to stop them from shaking. Mm. And that's the end of the chapter. Like, it's this little like punchline or at the end of each one.
Wait, okay. This sounds wonderful, but also I am filled with rage because it sounds like what our good friend Alexander is doing.
Alexa.
Alexis is doing is trying to set up a Jeopardy, like a game or maybe even a category based on his life. Like, he is setting himself up to be his life as trivia. So it sounds like he's just kind of like, he's building himself into the mythology of the show so that now people will have to study Alex Trebek's book and buy his book.
I don't like how negative you're being about Alex Trebek.
No, I'm just concerned that maybe it's just all a sellout and a money grab.
What?
You think it's a final money grab by Alex Trebek?
He's famous.
He's been always famous after for his dollar. Just
greed, his naked sheer greed.
I mean, he was the host of Jeopardy for 36 years. I'm not sure. Like, he hosted it
skimming
until
off the
like,
top, you think?
Yeah, I think he's okay. I don't know that.
Yeah, but
Alex
they gave all that money to
Merv
Griffin.
Grabs. They did.
So that sounds pretty fun.
Yeah, so
and it's very on trend, very digestible.
It's very digestible. It's very on trend. It is. So I read this book earlier this week, and it's a quick book to read. And I got to the end of it, and I had this very strange experience that I've never had for this show before, which is I had no idea what I was going to say about it. It was interesting enough. It was like bite-sized enough. It was like easy to read, easy to listen to. But I got to the end and it felt like there was just nothing there. Like, it was just all these anecdotes about Alex Trebek's life that
emptiness
sort of built a picture of it, but not really. You know what it reminds me of? Do you know, like,
what?
It's like when somebody dies and their house is full of stuff. Like, full of like just tons of
like
stuff.
Magazines and old jars of urine.
Yeah, that's exactly
peanut butter.
It. Magazine, jars of urine, old dishes,
some
right?
Jelly.
Yep. All good examples of things that people could leave
hair.
Behind.
Hair. Old hair.
Go ahead, Joe.
Yep.
Don't let us restrain you.
Maybe a knife.
It's like when somebody dies and their house is full of stuff, and all of that stuff was really meaningful to them. Like really genuinely meaningful to them, to the point that they kept it until the day they died. But when you look at it and you go through it, all you see is stuff that should be thrown away.
Cold-hearted bastard.
Wow.
So, like, you'll find a couple of interesting things. You'll find a book here that you like, or maybe like a Precious Moments doll that, you know, completes your collection or something
like that.
Peanut butter, yes. But, like, ultimately, like, it's not for you. It's like their stuff that built their life. That's kind of what reading this book feels like. And I don't want to be negative on Alex Trebek because I know that's what it sounds like. But when you get to the end of this book, like, that's the feeling that I ended up with, is I just didn't know
what to say. No emotional attachment.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Do you think this book is maybe just not for you then?
Alex Trebek, with the glimpses that you get of his life through Jeopardy, right? Like, just like the little jokes that he tells, the little bit of banter that he has with the contestants. I feel like we build him up to be this almost mythical figure in our lives. But when you read his book, there is a lot to like. Like, I think there's a lot of super admirable stuff in Alex Trebek's book. Like, he grew up legitimately lower middle class. Like, the way he got to be host of Jeopardy isn't through nepotism or any favors, but he worked his way up in the broadcasting industry and was really good at his jobs, and like kind of went from job to promotion to promotion to promotion until he was in LA with a beautiful wife driving a Rolls-Royce convertible. Like he's admirable and really cool in a lot of ways, but also you get to see a little too much behind the scenes and a little like some stuff where it's like, oh, I kind of wish I didn't know that about Alex Trebek.
Oh, like Scandal?
Well, never Scandal. Book, keep in mind, Joe, this is a first-person memoir. This is a first-person memoir that he wrote about his own life while he was dying. So not really Scandal.
Then I did a bunch of crimes. It was great. I loved it and I got away.
I don't want us to leave not liking Alex Trebek, because ultimately I still think Alex Trebek is the bee's knees.
You've certainly done him absolutely no favors
Thank
today,
you.
Joe.
He's fantastic. So the one thing that you can't come away from this without thinking is I think Alex Trebek is a little bit of a misogynist, right?
Jesus, Joe.
Well,
you need to
it's
back
really
up these claims
the lines,
with specific examples. You can't just for 20 minutes claim how he was shitty.
Okay, his first wife was a Playboy bunny. Okay. No, I'm going to keep going. I read an interview with him in Vanity Fair in which he is pretty defensive about the Me Too movement. It happened like kind of at the height of Me Too, and he brings it up unprompted a couple of times and how like people have to be careful. No, this is in an interview in Vanity Fair.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
When he and his first wife got divorced, which by the way was totally, amicable, like totally a lovely divorce, it sounds like they didn't hire a lawyer, they did it for a few hundred dollars in legal fees. He married a woman who was 26 years his junior. He was the age of her father. When women do well on sports questions, he is visibly surprised on the show.
No.
And the last story I'm going to tell, and this is like the moment where I started to get worried about Alex Trebek reading this book. By the way, love Alex Trebek. Read this book. He's fantastic.
Sounds like you hate Alex Trebek. Keep going.
Trebek talks about the very first time he was living in LA and had money for the first time. And he bought this right-hand drive Bentley with pure white and had like these beautiful leather seats in it and was just like this gorgeous car. He's driving around LA and Wilt Chamberlain of the center for the LA Lakers pulls up next to him driving a Rolls Royce. And Wilt Chamberlain toots his horn and he leans out the window over the lap of this beautiful blonde that Wilt Chamberlain has with him. And Wilt Chamberlain says, "That's a fine looking automobile." And Alex Trebek responds, "That's a fine looking companion," and speeds off. And that's a story that Alex Trebek chose to tell in his autobiography because he felt it made him look pretty cool. But I think it makes him look kind of douchey.
Does sound kind of douchey. Is it somehow charming? Are you somehow misrepresenting this?
I do think Alex Trebek is... The charming stuff about Alex Trebek is he is a consummate professional. Like, he is there to do a good job at his job. And when he comes across as a little bit smug, or when he comes across as like a little bit patronizing, it is him like stepping into that role of game show host. And
wow. So not the take I was expecting, but I guess what you're trying to say is good riddance, right? That's kind of your approach on this wonderful man's legacy. Time to move on. See what Kane can bring to the table.
Hey guys, I think Alex Trebek is awesome. I think you should read this book. You don't have to take my word for it. I love Alex Trebek.
You think you gave a pretty strong argument to not read this book, Joe?
Does it feel like Trebek is doing a thing with this book? Is this like, is he staking his kind of self mythologizing?
Yeah. What's
like,
the
this
point
is who
of the
I
book,
am.
Joe?
This is how I roll. So, or is it kind of like
overall message?
Is it slapdash? Is he trying to, is he just ending up kind of like, here's a bunch of stories about my life. Maybe I'll be a Jeopardy category someday. Or is this like, no, this is me. This is who, how I want to be remembered.
If you ask me, like, is there some, is this like a controlled narrative, like this swan song? Like, I'm very much in control of this message and I have one last thing that I want to say to the world. It doesn't feel like that. Like, it feels like the metaphor I keep coming back to is the cluttered house. It feels like here's all this stuff that I gathered over my life.
What's wrong with that? You make it sound like a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't think it is a bad thing. And I think in the end,
you could say that with a totally positive tone as well. It's just things he learned in his life.
I think that's fair. Because when you get to the end, like, I do think there's a concern of legacy. I think everybody has it to some extent. I don't know if it's a male thing or what, but I think like people are concerned with legacy. And I do feel like he's at the end of his life. He's 80 years old. He has a beautiful family. He's had a fantastic career. And I think in a lot of ways, he has no regrets about his life. But also, I think there's this need to like look at everything you've done, look at these like cool stories that you've gathered, look at the work you've done, and really hope that there's some impact there. But narratively, you don't feel that impact. You get little nuggets, you get fun little stories, you get little like behind the scenes looks at Jeopardy contestants or the way the game is played or Alex Trebek's youth, their family. Like that stuff is great. But narratively, I don't think there's a cumulative impact.
Interesting. Like he can never live up to the fantasy.
Right.
Like there is fantasy Alex and there is real life Alex. And
tell us about your fantasy Alex.
More about fantasy Alex.
Nothing can live up to fantasy Alex.
Oh, Alex.
So, hey guys, back, you may remember our legendary episode, Spooktacular Part 1.
I'm still shaking.
I know.
It's very spooky.
Queasy in my gullet. We pitted Dracula, which should have won, against The Turn of the Screw, which should not have won. Mm-hmm. And I'm not bitter about that. Anyway, Joe said something during that episode, which has stuck with me.
That was incredibly insightful.
Yeah, well, yes, it was incredibly insightful, and it was also a neat little historical tidbit. Mm-hmm. So Joe said that it used to be a habit to tell spooky stories at Christmas, and all of us, the rest of us, all two of us were...
The rest of me.
The rest of you and all of me were flummoxed by this idea, but I kind of think it might be good to return to the well-trodden ground of the spooktacular. What do you guys think?
And maybe find like a spooky Christmas ghost story.
Because it is, as they say, the Christmas season.
Christmas is all about spooky stories. Everybody knows that. Is there any one that comes to mind for you guys?
I don't know. I've been hearing the chains clanking, and I think it might be time to exorcise Marley's ghost and talk about a Christmas Carol.
Charles Dickens. Christmas Carol. Fantastic.
A Muppet Christmas Carol.
It's one of my favorites.
Okay. All right, ghost story, cool.
Spooktacular 2.
Are we gonna call it? Are we gonna call it Tooktacular because it's Spooktacular 2?
No.
Spooktacular. Spooktacular.
Spooktacular.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dreadful. I think we can just keep building upon this word for sure.
No end in sight.
Ian, tell us about the Scot.
The Scot. Scot. Great Scot.
Great Scot.
now listen, let me just get one thing clear. Let me clear the decks for this, for action. Let me
clear the decks for action. Clear the chamber.
Yeah.
I'm going to make spy type references.
Listen.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay.
I don't have a good Sean Connery impression. And I really don't want to do a disrespect to that man
because
he scares me and he will haunt me and possibly find a way to hurt me from beyond the grave if I disrespect his memory. So I'm going to respectfully abstain from doing my Sean Connery. If you guys want to be my guest, your blood be on your own head. I'm tagging out of that one.
So Ian, just right off the bat, was Sean Connery also a sexist?
Good question. Seems like it.
So this is a really interesting question. He started, he's kind of rumored to have said some really dreadful things about violence against women.
Really dreadful. Some less surprising things.
Well, so he...
I've thrown you off kilter.
Oh, boy. It's bad. he's
Joe, did you get that?
Yeah, I got it.
I got it. I'm trying to... I was just writing down the word bagpipes and trying to figure out how to work that into a sentence.
Because he's Scottish.
If you can, I'll be impressed. Right. So Connery is reported to have said there are two quotes which kind of circulate, which supposedly he said, and I could see it. Sure, I wouldn't be super surprised. He said in 2006, kind of after he retired and maybe had a chance to stop, you know, talking so much and just sort of think about his life. He has come out very strongly against violence against women and others.
What a hero.
I know. It's like, well, you're getting kind of old and now you say it, but, I do think it's an interesting thing because whether or not those reports of what he said are true, he seems to have kind of like cleaned up his act. So we've talked about a lot of dreadful people on this podcast, including actual Nazis, but we haven't really talked about folks accurate. Who seem to have like repented of their sins. So I was reading stuff about that and I was reading along and I'm like, oh boy. oh dear. So, and then he got to the part where he's like, I strongly condemn. And I was like, yes, thank you, Sean.
To Joe's point, it is concerning when that's a stance you have to take. So, Ian,
yep.
Tell us some happy things. Tell us about the wonderful world of Scotland.
Oh gosh, I got so much. Okay, so let me just start by saying, unlike maybe Alex Trebek's
evil Alex Trebek. Memoir,
I stand like by Alex Trebek. Alex Trebek is a great man.
This book does not dish the dirt. Oh. Sean Connery seems to have said, I like Scotland. I don't like publicity. So I'm going to use my publicity to make people realize how good Scotland is.
I love it.
Yeah.
This is like more of a tourism book.
It's funny. It's really strange because I think he believes it to be, like, based on how he writes it, he believes it to be, if you know Scotland, you'll know me.
Wow. And here's the 22 things you have to do in Scotland.
Brought to you by Froders.
Brought to you by BuzzFeed.
Lonely Planet's Guide to Scotland, written by Sean Connery.
It's amazing. Like I do think he really believes this. He doesn't. He was a private guy. He's passed on. He's dead. He was a private guy, and he was a secret agent. Sort of sharing. Yeah, he's secret. Like that's in the name.
Yeah,
he didn't like sharing his deets. So back in 2003, which is the year he retired from acting, he pulled out, there was this big autobiography deal, like a lucrative deal for an autobiography. And he pulled out of it because he said, I think the publisher is going to dig into my private life too deeply. And this is what he said. He said, I realized I was going to be spending the best part of my life and probably the rest of my life trying to correct these inaccuracies, and I can't be bothered.
I don't mind that.
No, he's like, great.
You know what? This is too personal. I don't want this. I want to do it on my own terms. And he did. And this book, every chapter in this, except for a couple early on, take on a different element of Scottish culture. So like history and art and literature and architecture, film industry. And it makes this wonderfully like this. It's just, it's an adorable argument. The argument of this book is very, very simple. Wait, Scotland is A, the first to do whatever it is, B, the best to do whatever it is, and or C, underappreciated in doing whatever it is.
Yeah, I love it. Where do we start, Ian?
I feel like we should all adopt that argument in our own lives. I was the first to do it. If I wasn't the first to do it, I was the best to do it. And if I'm neither of those things, you goddamn right, I am underappreciated when I do it.
It's adorable. And he's so like impassioned about it. For instance, we recently had the holiday of Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Yes, believe it or not, Sean Connery weighs in on Thanksgiving. And he says that we trace Thanksgiving back to Plymouth, right? The Pilgrims, Plymouth Rock.
Yeah. Plymouth Rock.
We trace it back to that, but we shouldn't. He says Thanksgiving should be traced back to the first settlement in America, Jamestown. And it just so happens that Jamestown was settled in part by Scottish people.
So is that basically just a good... That's a good example of what you can expect in this book, huh?
This feels like
it's a tame example
in your class. maybe like when you were a kid and you had a little friend who knew everything in the world there was to know about Stegosauruses, for example. Yep. And like everything you talked about, he brought up how Stegosaurus.
He could bring back to a Stegosaurus.
Yeah, like Stegafacts.
It all comes back to Scotland. Everything comes back to Scotland.
That's amazing.
It's an incredible gambit.
Yeah.
And like such a bold move for somebody to do in their memoir, autobiography. It's a memoir. It's not an autobiography, to say, hey, you know what? You came for the Connery facts, but I'm going to give you Scotland facts instead. And so many of them.
Like, is there anything we learn about him, or is it really just about that tourism?
I will say that before we get to him, I will say that it's weird because it almost works. Like,
yeah,
I almost started to give in. There's just so much, the sheer weight of all of his
is he like,
argumentation.
Would he like start a story about like the automobile and then like somehow trace the automobile back to Scotland?
In fact,
Did he do that exactly? He kind of
does that. Let me look in the index. Mm-hmm. No, he doesn't. I'm sorry. It's steam engines, though. Definitely steam engines.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, that's basically the automobile before there were automobiles.
Right.
Yeah. Did he invent the Scottish people, the good people of Scotland, invent the wheel?
Probably. If you gave Sean Connery long enough, he
enough
would argue
time.
Around to
he
that
could get
point.
There. He could
so
get
give
there.
Do you have any fun examples of this, Ian? I know you gave us one brief one.
Oh boy. So,
what made you give up the most?
Well, completely. Really, like, this is my favorite, I think. He loves The Simpsons.
Okay.
I know this because he points triumphantly to The Simpsons as like proof that, look, the Scottish are super important on a couple of different occasions. Mm. And he goes to the length of reproducing images, like stills from The Simpsons. There are a lot of pictures in this book.
Okay.
And so he's got some pictures from The Simpsons, some frames. Oh, he also reflects on the gardener in The Simpsons. Angus,
Groundskeeper Willie?
Groundskeeper Willie, He talks all about how that is a testimony to how the Scots are always so good at keeping up yards and landscaping.
Keep going. Please finish the thought. And that they're really good at yards, so you should, whenever you look at your yard, you should appreciate me and Scotland
and also The Simpsons
and also The Simpsons. So I know nothing about Sean Connery besides that he was James Bond. What did you learn about Sean Connery that would compel me or anybody on this planet who's not Scottish to want to read this book?
Okay, so there are two answers to this question. First of I'll kind of tease answer two, and then I'll get to answer one in a sort of reverse
kind of like
style.
A prequel.
The bigger answer, is that this book gives an impression of who this person was. It gives us an impression of Sean Connery. It doesn't give us a detailed portrait of the history of his life, but it gives us an idea of his personality. We'll get to that in a second. But first, I'd like to play a game of my own.
There is
some fun, juicy facts and stories about Sean Connery, the man. And I could list them for you, but instead I want to do a fill in the blank exercise. So, here's how it's
like
going to
work. Like a Mad Libs? Or?
The easiest type of test after multiple choice or true and false
it's
is
true.
Fill in the blank.
I'm going to give you most of the facts.
Fill in the blank is the hardest of the test type questions. Because you have to come up with the answer.
Yeah,
that's true.
Do we have a word bank? Do we have a word bank?
Oh,
you
is there a word bank?
No, there is no word bank. You have, but these
bagpipes.
Uh, these facts are going to be kind of like, it's going to lead into it. So you won't have much to,
okay, we're ready.
It won't be that hard. So here you go. I'm going to read you most of a fact and I'm going to leave out the key point. And your job is to guess what fills the blank.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'll tell you that Sean Connery made a documentary about shipyards and the Soviet Union saw it. And well, sorry, first they saw all the James Bond movies. They thought he was a capitalist because he played James Bond, the secret agent tool of capitalism. But then they saw the shipyard documentary and they realized this is a friend of the working man. So they did what?
Propagandized.
Mm-hmm. Did they propagandize him?
They invited him to star in a Soviet movie, which I believe he did.
Fantastic.
Here's Love another it. One.
Man, we need that word bank.
All right. you guys each get 50 points.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. Here's another one. When he was younger, he worked for a coffin maker. And sometimes, to save on train fare home, he brought a flask of tea and blank.
To save on train fare home, he brought a flask of tea and...
whiskey.
Yeah, scotch, obviously.
No, what did he do?
Oh, and drank it.
he brought a flask of tea and walked.
No, he slept in the coffins at night.
Spooktacular.
Spooktacular for sure. So there was a point he really, really wanted to be a professional soccer player. No, neither of you get 50 points for that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
He really wanted to be a professional soccer player, but he also was doing well as an actor and he was going to choose soccer. And an older actor came along and told him, you can play soccer for 10 years. You can act all your life. What did he choose to do?
I think he chose to play soccer and then probably went into acting afterwards.
I'm going to say he beat that guy up.
He chose to act.
Oh, okay. That makes sense because we do know him for being a famous actor. So that
right,
makes
right,
sense.
Not
that
Sean Connery, the famous actor.
Yeah, I thought
player.
This was more of a trick question.
Mm-hmm. No. Okay. We got one more, which is my favorite. This book is peppered with Sean Connery just like, this is what I think about this thing.
Yeah.
And most of the time they're relatively tame. Mostly the English are terrible, but sometimes he gets really crazy. Like when he says, he's talking about soccer and he says he believes soccer comes from a Viking tradition of doing what?
Oh, cutting off the heads of your enemies and like kicking them around.
Kicking the heads.
Yeah, kicking the heads around the town.
Come on, that's the one that we got?
Yeah,
that's the one that we got. Beheading your enemy and then kicking your head around the town. So each of you take another 50 points.
That's fantastic.
And for our tiebreaker to end this, it's a Hobbit fact time.
Oh, yes.
And you guys, this will be the first collaborative Hobbit fact.
Okay.
Sean Connery was offered a role in the Lord of the Rings films. He turned it down because he said, I didn't understand it. And the role would have earned him $500 million, $30 million plus 15% of the worldwide box office. So hugely lucrative role. He was offered this role. He turned it down. He said, I didn't understand it. And I'll take each of you in turn. Joe.
Yes.
What role did Sean Connery turn down?
Well, first of all, I would like to, did you say $500 million?
Yes. $450 million.
That's better than Jeopardy money.
Did he know that at the time that he'd be turning down $500 million?
He turned down 30 million plus 15% of the worldwide box office.
Wow.
And 15%, I don't know if you guys know, but that's a huge percentage.
A monstrous percentage.
That's insane. Did the actor who ended up getting this job, did he get that same deal? Or was it because he was Sean Connery?
I don't believe he did.
Man, what?
I think he turned down Gandalf. That's the only thing that makes sense.
And Nick, what do you think?
I actually know the answer to this one.
Because you Googled it?
Well, no, this popped up on Reddit.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
So do you want me to give you the answer? Or
please,
please
adjudicate this. Give us our Hobbit fact.
I believe it was Gandalf, but then I think they, as a follow-up, offered him Saruman.
Ooh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
So do you want to tell, maybe you know this, Ian, do you want to tell the story about his his falling out with Hollywood?
I do know this, but Nick, it's your time to shine. Tell the story.
Oh, walk fantastic. Like the beacon of Gandalf's stick. So
Gandalf's stick.
Gandalf's famous stick.
I'll butcher this for you guys real quickly. Basically, his last movie was... Okay, no. So this is the order. So they offered him Gandalf. He says, no, I don't want to do that. It sounds terrible. He doesn't understand it, quote unquote.
I don't understand this.
And I don't want $30 million? That's
which by itself, like
$500 million.
Who cares what the movie is? So he's either got just crazy integrity or I don't know what. The movie becomes...
the biggest movie in the history of the world.
Biggest movie ever, biggest franchise ever at the time. And he gets super depressed. Now, after that, there's another movie and he's offered a star role.
I'm trying to think what else was big.
Oh, it was the main. He was offered the architect. He was offered the role of the architect.
Oh, yes. Cool.
So he was offered Matrix. He didn't understand it. Very reasonable.
I understand two things. I understand Scotland and shipyards, damn it. And if my next role isn't about Scotland or shipyards, I'm not taking it.
Or objectifying women. And so he turns that down, another incredibly successful franchise. And then here comes along the most, the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Well, one second, though. Written by genius, comic genius, friend of the podcast, Alan Moore, right?
Alan Moore.
Oh, yep. Good call.
We have the adaptation. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the adaptation flops, and he's like, well, I clearly don't know what I'm doing anymore or how to pick scripts, and and that was it. He gives up. Like, right. So moves to the Caribbean with already millions of dollars.
He was involved trying to save League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He got involved in like the editing and stuff, and apparently even he, whatever that means, he couldn't save it.
Even Sean Connery couldn't save that movie.
And he was apparently in talks with Steven Spielberg to come back for the Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull. But in a rare moment of turning down a bad movie, Sean Connery said, I don't think this is a good part for me. And he did not come out of retirement to play Indy's dad.
Can you imagine the 1-2 kick in the nuts that would have been if he finished on League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, then came out of retirement to be in Crystal Skull?
So that's how his movie career ended.
That is how his movie career ended.
Which is pretty depressing, but like how bad can you feel for him? Like he's an icon.
Yeah.
So
yeah, he like retired in the Bahamas at NASA?
In NASA.
Yeah, when he was, what, 60 years old?
He went to space using NASA, yeah. So you always get the impression, kind of reading this book, that he likes acting okay. It's fine. But he's not like, he doesn't live for it. Like some guys, some folks, like some actors just devote... They give themselves completely to it. And Sean Connery has a lot of other interests. And, you know, he uses his film career for a lot of examples. There's a whole like thing about him and his love for horses and all the times he rode horses in his movies. It's just like, it was never the only thing for him.
Right.
I have a question. Would this be a good book to read to learn about Scotland?
Oh my gosh. This is one of my why you should read this. If you want to learn a lot about Scotland.
Okay.
This is it.
Do you feel like pretty accurate? It's like a good representation, or do you think it's a little skewed towards the tourism board?
the pro Scott bias.
If anything, it's skewed against the tourism board. He consulted with a bunch of experts and stuff. This is scrupulously researched. It's very solid on its Scottish history, culture stuff. I learned a ton. Stuff that I'll never, ever use, but there it is. If I go on Jeopardy, maybe. It's also, I would say, the other reason you should read this book is because it's like a masterclass in how you can write a memoir and still be private. Mm. Like... You get an idea of how his mind works. You get an idea of what he's interested in. You get an idea of kind of how he thinks about the world. he doesn't say like, here's all the times I did some drugs, or this is what I yelled at Wilt Chamberlain.
Yeah.
But you do get a sense of like how he thinks about the world. And that's kind of cool. It's more, almost more intimate to know the way his mind works than to know all the crazy shenanigans he got up to.
The dirt.
Right. Folks, I'll just say while Nick is kind of preparing to name his winner here, I'll just encourage you to hop on over, and I do mean hop on over to our website, youdontknowlitpodcast.com. Submit a book there if you are so inclined, or even if you're not inclined, you just want to give us something to do. We're coming up on winter break and we'll need something to do during that time. We're also all active on all over different kinds of social media. And you can find this podcast wherever podcasts are casted. So give us a review. Give us a 5-star review over at the iTunes store, the Apple store. What is it called?
Yeah, no, you got it. That was it.
iTunes, Apple, whatever that thing is. I'm an Android boy. And tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell your significant others, tell your insignificant others, tell random strangers.
Those might all be the same people.
Shout it from the rooftops.
Sick burn.
Well, Joe, you definitely lose. Ian.
Yeah.
Do you have a quote?
I do. This is in his words. He loves golf. He lives for golf, which makes sense because golf was invented in
Scotland. That's on brand, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's hugely important, and he loves it. And I'll tell you just how much he loves it. This is what he says. I began to see golf as a metaphor for living. For in golf, you are basically on your own, competing against yourself and always trying to do better. If you cheat, you will be the loser because you are cheating yourself. When Ian Fleming portrayed Auric Goldfinger as a smooth cheater, James Bond had no regrets when he switched his golf balls, since to be cheated is the just reward of the cheater.
That might be the greatest sell on golf I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's good.
Golf is a metaphor for living.
I tell my students that about tennis, but they don't care.
Thank you.